The possibility that the government may move to block investment funds from buying up entire housing estates generates the lead story in today's Irish Times and Irish Examiner. Both Taoiseach Micheál Martin and Tánaiste Dlí Ó Bhuradkar expressed their unhappiness with the practice yesterday after they came under fire following reports that investment funds had bought up entire developments of family homes. The Times reports, however, that there is a belief in government that investment funds should not be chased out of the market entirely, as they have an important role to play in providing funding for certain types of developments, such as large-scale apartment schemes in urban areas. According to the Examiner, the option of banning foreign investors from purchasing all properties apart from high-density city centre developments is under consideration, as is the possibility of ring-fencing 30% of all developments for first-time buyers. For its lead story, the Irish Daily Mail takes the line that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael moved to blame each other for the housing crisis during parliamentary party meetings last night. The Irish Independent leads this morning with the plan to introduce minimum pricing on alcohol. Senan Maloney reports that the price of 1.32, which has been suggested as the minimum a can of beer will cost, is based on a 440 millilitre can of 4% strength beer versus the more commonly sold 500 millilitre can, which is likely to cost at least 1.50. Stronger beers are also expected to cost more, which means that many brands may in fact cost closer to €2 a can. An interview with the father of a 17-year-old girl who was knocked onto the train track at Howth Junction in Dublin while she was waiting for a Dart on the 1st of April is carried on the front of today's Irish Sun. She was helped back onto the platform afterwards and luckily only suffered minor injuries. Gardaí are investigating the incident, which was captured on CCTV, which shows a youth on a bicycle at the scene where the girl fell. And for its lead story, the Irish News reports that patients suffering from rheumatoid arthritis and other debilitating diseases are facing 334-week delays for an appointment with a consultant in Northern Ireland. The Belfast Telegraph leads with the story about allegations against a locum doctor who worked at a number of hospitals in the UK and Northern Ireland between 2016 and 2018, which are being examined by a medical practitioners tribunal panel. And finally, the Times is a story today about members of the Magazine Road Residents Association in Cork who hit the headlines last summer when they campaigned against lockdown parties in rented houses in their area. Barry Roach writes that they were out on the streets again yesterday, not to protest, but to plant trees in memory of members of their community who died in the past year or so. Chairwoman Catherine Clancy tells Roach that many who attended were elderly, so it was emotional and uplifting for them to be involved in yesterday's ceremony after the year we've all had.
A betrayal of victims, a slap in the face for victims, a unilateral action on a sensitive issue the Irish government strongly advised against. That's just some of the reaction to the news the British government will bring in an amnesty for crimes committed during the Troubles. Our Northern editor Vincent Kearney has the story, which came out in London overnight. Vincent, talk to us about what's being planned, and we've heard already some of the reaction from the SDLP, Sinn Féin, the Irish government in my introduction there, but also give us the context for this decision from London.
And well, in terms of context, dealing with the legacy of the past is the most controversial and sensitive unresolved political issue in Northern Ireland. Politicians simply haven't been able to reach agreement. Although back in 2014, they did sign the Stormont House Agreement that brought together all the main political parties in Northern Ireland, along with the British and Irish governments, and it set out a pathway to deal with the legacy of the past. Although it still hasn't been implemented. Now, it included an independent historical investigations unit, which would examine all unsolved troubles related to deaths and give victims sort of what they wanted, because many victims, while they don't want prosecutions, they do want to know the truth about what happened, but others do want prosecutions. Now, the idea on you of an amnesty isn't new in itself. 8 years ago, I interviewed the then Attorney General, John Larkin QC, and he said it was time, in his view, to draw a line under the past, to draw a line in the sand, because he said with each passing year, the prospect of prosecutions and convictions reduced. Now, that was met with universal anger across the political spectrum, but that sounds very like the kind of idea the British government is now proposing. She said, reported overnight after media briefings, the Daily Telegraph and the Times newspapers reporting this move is to be announced in the Queen's speech next week. It claimed this legislation would introduce a ban on any prosecutions of former British soldiers for any alleged crimes, killings before the Good Friday Agreement was signed in 1998. But not only that, this would apply across the board, include former members of the IRA and loyalist paramilitary groups. That only is because a number of years ago, a Defence Select Committee of the House of Commons looked at this issue in detail. That Defence Committee recommended that there should not be prosecutions of soldiers, but it also said that legal advice it had received made it very clear that the government could not act unilaterally and only protect soldiers, that this would have to be rolled out across the board for all killings and the Troubles. Now, the Irish government has known that this has been about in terms of an idea. It has been briefed on this as a possible idea and on a number of occasions, but on each occasion, the Irish government has made it very clear it's opposed to it. It remains fully committed to the Stormont House Agreement. It says anything else would betray victims, would let victims down, and would be insensitive. And it appears that the government had no advance notice yesterday that this was going to be leaked to the media in terms of possibly an imminent announcement on this very sensitive issue coming as early as next week.
Which is curious, isn't it, Vincent? Because, of course, there was the meeting yesterday between Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney and Northern Secretary Brandon Lewis. A breach of the Stormont House Agreement unilaterally by one side. The key question is, was it discussed at that meeting?
My understanding is, Anya, that a range of issues were discussed at that meeting, including legacy issues. As I said, the government was aware that the British government, the authorities, have been thinking about a number of options for dealing with legacy. So they weren't entirely blindsided, that they did have some kind of knowledge that this might be being discussed. But as I say, my understanding is it was discussed between Simon Coveney and Brandon Lewis, but the Minister for Foreign Affairs again made the Irish government's position very clear, which is it remains fully committed to the Stormont House Agreement and advised the UK authorities against any such move because, as you say, it said it was very insensitive. Brandon Lewis got on the plane after the meeting, went to London. Simon Coveney went to Brussels. My understanding is that the Irish government then found out through media reports that this has been leaked and was being talked about, been introduced, as I say, as early as next week. Now, again, my understanding is that the UK authorities at political and official level were immediately left in no doubt about the level of anger, dismay and concern coming from Dublin. As we heard earlier, political leaders here as well, Michelle O'Neill, the Deputy First Minister, Colm Eastwood, the SDLP leader, were very quick to issue statements because this is a highly sensitive issue. Politicians here have been concerned, very worried that the British government might try some move like this for a number of years now because of the lack of implementation of that Stormont House Agreement. Now, we've been here before. There have been reports for the past couple of years that the Queen's speech would include this kind of a move to end prosecutions for soldiers. But there is a bit of a head of steam here, as I said. There appears to be a widespread briefing, a number of major newspapers across the UK covering the story today, and an expectation that this time around the British government might be serious. So I think the Irish government will be very keen today to apply as much pressure as it possibly can on the UK authorities not to go ahead with this move.
And we'll be hearing from the SDLP leader Colm Eastwood in just a moment and from Green Party leader Eamon Ryan after eight. But two other issues, Vincent, for you. Sinn Féin replacing its Derry team. Who are they going to put in with elections next year or even sooner if power sharing doesn't survive the autumn?
That's not clear yet at this stage. All we know is, Anya, they were very keen to remove the two incumbents, Martina Anderson, the former MEP, former junior minister, and Karen Mullen. They were viewed as deeply unpopular in Derry. So the party leadership, they undertook a major review of the entire party structures after they had what was a disastrous Westminster election result in 2019. The person you're going to have on shortly, Colm Eastwood, won the seat back for the SDLP with a majority of over 17,000, the largest majority ever in the Foyle constituency. So Sinn Féin realised something was wrong. They brought in what was described as a team of number crunchers. They looked at all the numbers and all the voter patterns. The feedback they got was that if these two MLAs remained in place, there was a very strong possibility Sinn Féin could lose both those seats in the next Assembly election next May. And then, of course, the big picture here on you is that in that next election, Sinn Féin wants to become the largest political party in Northern Ireland for the first time. DUP only has one seat more than at this stage, so if it lost those two seats, it would make that dream impossible. But also, and very importantly, that would have put pressure on Michelle O'Neill and raised questions about her leadership, and coming just a week after Arlene Foster was forced to stand down from the DUP, it looks like Sinn Féin is taking action to sort of to nip that in the bud and try to remove any problems further down the line.
Northern editor Vincent Kearney, thank you.
Eastwood, the SDLP leader, has been listening to Vincent Kearney there talking to Áine. He joins me now. Colm Eastwood, good morning.
Morning, Marie.
Your reaction to this move for an amnesty plan for soldiers, it's really clear you've called it the biggest betrayal of victims by the British government. But you must have known that this move was more than a possibility.
We've been worried about this coming for quite some time, particularly because Sinn Féin and the British government in 2005 actually agreed an amnesty, and we stepped in and opposed it when we found out and put pressure on Sinn Féin to back away from that position. Thankfully they did, but this has been the British government's intention, I think, for quite some time. They haven't spoken to victims about this, they haven't spoken to other parties about this, and my clear understanding is that they've gone unilaterally and briefed the Tory press in London without agreeing this with the Irish government. It's an absolute disgrace, and it is a real betrayal of all of those people who lost loved ones throughout the Troubles. We have a trial going on right now of a soldier of Bloody Sunday, Soldier F. We have an inquest being announced, the findings of it being announced next Tuesday into the Ballymurphy massacre by the Parachute Regiment. We have so many of these cases, and so many of these ordinary people have been put through turmoil for decades, and this British government just doesn't care, and they're prepared to ride roughshod over all of that. And even worse, it means it's going to be very, very difficult to have proper and true reconciliation if we hide the truth from the public and from future generations.
But is it here that the unilateral action, as you call it, the briefing of media in London and the leaking of a plan to have it included now in the Queen's speech, or is it the very action itself? Are you on board with, how to deal with these legacy issues, an amnesty on all sides?
No, absolutely not. We are not. We fully believe that every victim is entitled to seek truth and to get access to truth. We also believe people are entitled to seek justice. Justice is not always possible in every case, given the passing of time and everything else. But people are entitled to seek it, and people are entitled to be offered it and a proper investigation into what happened to their loved ones. We need the truth as much as anything else, because it has all been hidden, and the glorification of violence that went on over the past number of decades is not good for our society. Our society is sick. We haven't reconciled with each other. We can't do that, in my view, unless we properly deal with this issue. You know, we've tried not to deal with it since 1998. It hasn't got us anywhere. It has just left people even more hurt, and it has created more division in our society. So we have to deal with this. We want to move on, but the best way to move on is to properly deal with this. Unilateral announcements, the night before an election in England, is no way of dealing with the peace process, and no way of looking after the victims, the people who suffered most. While the rest of us are allowed to move on, they still have to suffer with the scars, the physical and mental scars of what happened.
And I suppose while these briefings were taking place perhaps in London yesterday, Brandon Lewis, the Secretary of State, and Simon Coveney were meeting, and it has led to the announcement that the intergovernmental conference meetings, none held for 2.5 years, that they seem to be back on track after that significant gap. That's a move you will welcome.
Well, it's obviously something we have called for. We know that Boris Johnson has had no interest whatsoever in dealing with the issues that have emerged in Northern Ireland over the past number of months. But I mean, how do we take anything that they say truthful and honest when they announce that they're going to re-engage properly with the Irish government. They have a meeting with the Irish government, and then they go behind their backs and brief the Tory press that one of the key tenets of the peace process, they're just going to go and do their own thing anyway. So I just think it makes it very difficult for any of us to have any faith in this British government. I think they're the most cynical and untrustworthy government, British government, that we have seen in many years, and that's frankly, that's saying something.
Colm Eastwood, leader of the SDLP, thank you.
To Longford next, and a Garda investigation into a wedding celebration with more than 120 people at a marquee on the outskirts of Longford town. Our Midlands correspondent Kieran Mullooly has the story. Kieran, how did this unfold through yesterday?
Anya, this actually began on Tuesday afternoon when Longford County Council and the Gardaí said they became aware of plans to stage this post-wedding party in a private marquee on land not far from the town centre, actually. Now, the Longford Gardaí said they got involved initially. They spoke to the family involved and they outlined to them the restrictions of the COVID-19 pandemic. But they said there was no engagement. So at that point, Longford County Council chose to go to court. They went to Sligo Circle Court yesterday morning to get an order, which effectively gave them the authority to remove the marquee. The Longford County Council told the court and the judge involved that the marquee was adjacent to a halting site in the town owned by the County Council, and they wanted to take measures to ensure this happened. But yesterday afternoon then, the situation unfolded whereby the wedding was taking place at St. Mel's Cathedral in Longford town, and negotiations were going on between the Gardaí and the council and the families involved. Now, I understand around lunchtime those discussions broke up, and the Longford Gardaí said that they were there to support the local authority in the enforcement of the order, but that the local authority and its agents withdrew from the situation. So throughout the afternoon, it would appear that the wedding plans went ahead, and last night, as we saw on the 9 o'clock news, the function itself went ahead in the marquee in Longford town.
Where is the Garda investigation at now, Kieran?
Well, Superintendent Jim Delaney is the Longford superintendent in charge of this investigation. He says that they will pursue every avenue open to them today in terms of their investigation, the continuing investigation. That will include speaking to a number of people who were at the event last night, and he said their investigation will be thorough and that they will pursue it with a view to putting a file together with regard to whether or not a breach of the COVID-19 regulations has taken place. There has been a lot of reaction overnight, Anya, in the area. Longford County Council chairperson is Councillor Paul Ross at the moment. He said that the council had taken every measure to try and deal with the situation. So last night he explained to me some of their frustrations at what had happened.
This came to our attention yesterday that there's going to be a mass gathering after a wedding in Longford town. Straight away the council acted on this, and I believe we're one of the first local authorities in the country to get a court injunction to take down the marquee in which the event was going to be held. So I believe the council work proactively on that to try and prevent this mass gathering. Obviously, we're in the midst of a pandemic, so it is very, very disappointing this evening to find out that there are people in the tent down there, that the court order has not been able to be carried out. We had the support of the Gardaí. As I said, the elected members of Longford County Council and myself were fully behind this, and it's very disappointing that it wasn't carried out this evening. The numbers in Longford have been high over the last couple of months, and like, we have to remember, people have taken huge sacrifices over the last 12 months. So for people in the community to blatantly disregard these rules, have a mass gathering in a town where there is a problem, it's just totally unacceptable.
And listening to the chair of the county council there, Councillor Paul Ross, speaking to you, Kieran, a lot of local upset.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the first incident of this nature in recent months, Anya. There was a similar type of event in County Leitrim, listeners may remember, about 8 weeks ago. And in the community itself, I suppose, where the restrictions are still in place, even though restrictions are coming to an end in many areas in terms of travel, etc., last night's event has caused considerable anger among the politicians and the public. On social media, there are images of the wedding ceremony itself in operation at the moment, and to be seen there. Though it has to be said that, you know, the initial number suggested that up to 200 people were at this function. Clearly from the video pictures on social media, it looks like less than 100 people were at the event involved. But nevertheless, the fallout will continue today, nevertheless.
All right, Kieran, thank you for reporting on that for us. That's our Midlands correspondent, Kieran Mullooly.
And to the United States now, where President Joe Biden has thrown his support behind waiving intellectual property rights for COVID-19 COVID-19 vaccines. His support for a waiver, a sharp reversal of the previous US position, could potentially expand the global supply of vaccines and narrow the gap between rich and poor nations. The president has also laid out plans to vaccinate 70% of the US population by July the 4th, though there are signs that the pace of vaccination is slowing. Suzanne Lynch is the Irish Times Washington correspondent. She's been telling me more first about this potential waiver on COVID vaccine patents.
Well, I think this is potentially extremely significant. This debate about whether to waive intellectual property protections for COVID vaccines has been in the ether here now for months. You've had a lot of figures on the left in America. A number of Democratic members of Congress, up to 100, had just written a letter to President Biden asking him to consider this waiver on these IP protection for patents, believing that this is necessary to speed up the shots that are getting to billions of people across the world. So a lot of people did not think this was going to come from the United States. There was a lot of debate within the White House about whether to go ahead with this or whether not to. In the end, the new US Trade Representative, Catherine Tai, announced yesterday that this would happen, that the United States would support this. Now, they are going to now move to discussion phase at the WTO. Obviously, the US is only one of those countries at the WTO, but the fact that the US now backs it means that it is more likely to happen.
Could we characterise this as President Joe Biden siding with poorer countries and not with Big Pharma in his own country?
Yes, I think we can. American pharmaceutical companies have a lot of power in this country, and Joe Biden was under pressure from them, not just about the obvious point about profit for pharmaceuticals, but also the argument from that sector that by waiving this protection on patents that would allow maybe some other competitors like China and Russia, producers in those countries to effectively copy, as they see it, American IP. So it is a bit of a landmark decision by the Biden administration. Again, the pharmaceutical companies worry that this is perhaps a precedent. What happens when the next vaccine is needed? Will these companies, they say, be as keen to develop vaccines so quickly like they have this time if they feel that, as they see it, their intellectual property rights will not be protected? Mm. But no, I think it is very important. It's, again, a significant move in how Joe Biden is choosing to govern. He has obviously gone much more to the left in a lot of ways than many people had been expecting. And I think this is probably at this stage another example of that.
And yet, Suzanne, when I hear you say that it'll move on to discussion phase, it suggests that this isn't going to happen anytime soon.
Well, that is true. Now, Catherine Tai said they would engage now with the WTO looking at the text of an agreement. So, like all multilateral organisations, the WTO in Geneva is going to have to bring all these countries together on this. This move had been backed by countries like India, South Africa, but now it has to get agreement for all members, if you like. So this could take a long time, and B, this proposal could get watered down, could get changed or developed as these negotiations begin. So we will have to wait and see what the final outcome of this is.
And meanwhile, on the home front, President Biden has been forging ahead with the vaccine rollout with a fairly ambitious target, 70% vaccinated by Independence Day, by the 4th of July. Will he achieve it?
Well, I think what we're going to see from the White House are a real push now to try and keep up the levels of vaccinations that we've been seeing. What appears to be happening in the last few weeks is that the number of people getting vaccinated has plateaued. Now, in one sense, this was expected. Obviously, there was a rush of people who really wanted to get vaccinated, who queued up and who got on the list very quickly when this supply of vaccines came on stream about a month, 6 weeks ago. Now what we're seeing is that the average rate, daily rate, is decreasing. Now, the White House this week has effectively signalled a shift in strategy. It's talked about making vaccines more accessible, bringing them to rural communities, for example, rather than running these huge mass vaccination sites we're seeing in a lot of cities here. They're talking about now moving more towards mobile pop-up clinics, or allowing chemists and pharmacies to offer vaccine vaccines to people without appointments. So it's all about access at the moment. Of course, the other part of this is going to be trying to convince people who are hesitant to take the vaccine to take it up. I think one interesting trend here has been there was a lot of discussion about communities of colour and how traditionally some of these communities were hesitant because of past experience from the government about taking vaccines. In fact, the message seems to have got through in a lot of those more urban communities. What we're seeing now is that in some rural communities, white majority communities, which tend to have voted a lot for Donald Trump, that the take-up is quite low. So what we're probably going to see by the administration is an effort to get into those more rural communities and try and get more people vaccinated.
Suzanne Lynch of the Irish Times.
And as the country prepares to emerge from a long and difficult lockdown, people can begin to look to the future with hope and optimism. For some, however, the change in restrictions is bringing its own challenges, as Elise Sheehy reports.
I feel like my world has shrunk so much. Like, I'd be quite a social person, but there's this weird kind of juxtaposition between wanting to meet up and talk with people and then being constantly on edge. I don't like people seeing me like that, you know?
Life during the pandemic has been difficult for 25-year-old Anna Buckley from Ballybunion in County Kerry. She lives with her parents, who are vulnerable but are now fully vaccinated. Anna has an underlying medical condition and hasn't yet received her COVID-19 jab.
I'm living with my parents, who are 75, and they'd be in the high-risk category. I've had to be quite careful with that.
How did you feel following the announcement last week of the easing of restrictions?
I suppose for other people, I felt happy. I can kind of get back to a small slice of reality. But for me, I'm still not vaccinated. I was still a bit apprehensive.
And what are your main concerns?
Getting sick from COVID. Like, I do have asthma, but it's mostly me infecting other people, infecting my parents.
Anna describes one recent experience when she met up with her friend outdoors.
She was also in a similar situation of living with vulnerable people and also being vulnerable herself. After I met her for like a half an hour, I was actually crying when I was in the car driving home because I was like, oh God, was that worth it?
From Monday, up to 3 households can meet outdoors, which includes meeting in private gardens. Anna describes how she would feel in a situation like this.
I don't want to be saying no to people, but I also don't want to be flaking out at the last minute. I'd rather not see people at all than to have them see me being someone that they don't recognise in terms of anxiety levels and just not being fun to be around.
Hello there. Hello, how are you, Ned?
I hope you brought the good weather with you.
In Navan, County Meath, 86-year-old Ned Brady and his wife Rita, who is 69, don't have any plans to meet unvaccinated people indoors. Ned has been fully vaccinated while Rita is still waiting to get her second dose.
I have to say I would be nervous about it. I personally would prefer that people were fully vaccinated before they came to visit.
Our own sons, even at this stage, they'll come to the door, but they won't come in. So I would be afraid of people coming around the place that weren't vaccinated.
Ned and Rita are also hesitant to meet up with other households outdoors when restrictions ease.
I would feel totally nervous. Always being an anxious sort of person, it wouldn't come easy to me to start socialising again. I would still hold on to that anxiety for the present time. Please God, it'll go away in time.
It's not gone away, you know. Still around. So you'd have to be more than careful, I think, anyway.
Hi, Jane, how are you?
Hi, Eilish, I'm fine, thank you.
Jane Gribben, a humanistic and integrative psychotherapist based in Malahide, County Dublin, says some people can find it difficult to readjust after spending so long in lockdown.
I have some clients that are still very anxious about the thoughts of things opening up. They have concerns about people aren't being vaccinated, people are being vaccinated, and they're exposing themselves to a lot more activity.
This feeling of anxiety, is it confined to just one age group of clients that you're seeing?
No, Eilish, it's across the board. Yeah, I'm working with quite a few younger people, middle-aged, older people, and it is across the board. people have been cocooning for quite a long time, and then suddenly for things to really open up quite rapidly, it's a bit of a shock to the system. So psychologically, you have to readjust. That fear and anxiety just doesn't dissipate straight away.
Jane has some advice for people who might feel anxious about restrictions being relaxed.
Be mindful of their own self-care, not to overcommit themselves socially to things. People are practicing meditation and mindfulness exercises regularly, and that can really help people stay grounded and balanced, because the mind can run away with thoughts. We're bombarded with thoughts, 60, 70-odd thousand thoughts a day, and a lot of them can be quite negative. So we have to have ways of calming the mind down. Being in nature and practicing present moment awareness using your senses helps people just to really come into the here and now.
These people in Navan have mixed views on emerging from lockdown in the coming weeks.
I hope now it may lift for the summer. We might get away for a weekend. But as regards the pubs, I still think I would be very iffy about the crowd gathering there. Like, you know,
it's up to yourself how much you want to engage yourself with other people. It's your choice. They have to bite the bullet sooner or later, but we'll see how it goes.
I definitely would have preferred to see more people vaccinated, but on the other hand, I don't feel that the government have much of a choice, because people are starting to come out more. Now people know the vaccinations are coming, so they're taking more risks.
I am going back into retail myself. I'd like to have my vaccine by the time I get back, because I know when I was at work there around the Christmas time when we went back, people were on top of you, and it's going to be like this again.
Interesting, the thoughts of people in Navan on reopening. They're talking to our reporter, Eilidh Sheehy.
The conference organisers here are warning that their sector will be the last to recover post-pandemic, and they've called for an extension of state supports and clarity around the return of regular international travel. The Association of Irish Professional Conference Organisers holds its annual conference today virtually and says it needs help in order to confidently plan for 2022 and beyond. Marina Finn is co-chair of the AIPCO. She joins me on the line now. Marina, the government has promised an outline of a plan for future supports by the end of this month. They've also promised no cliff edge. So what else are you looking for?
Good morning, Adam. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. I suppose over the last 14 months, and due to the pandemic and the associated travel restrictions, our reality is that we've had little or no business. And sadly, in 2021, we anticipate that we will have a second year. We've had no business because essentially we are entirely reliant on the overseas international delegate attending. You know, in terms of a plan from our side and what we need, as you said, we really are calling on the government to extend the EWSS until April 2022 and to allocate further grants for our sector. This is really key. We really see this as a temporary measure going forward, and really a bridge to recover in 2022. You know, we appreciate the subsidies and the assistance that we have been given, but we really see this as a core part of us being able to keep our doors open and to being able to maintain the experience and expertise we have in our industry. Also, I suppose just what's also important is that we have a roadmap, and in terms of taking on the challenges of international travel, we understand how difficult it is, but this will give confidence to our international delegates to choose Ireland over other destinations.
Well, even if you do get the roadmap, realistically at this stage, it's going to be next year before there's any activity in the sector because of the planning that's involved.
That's correct, Adam. I mean, our business is a very long lead-in business, but we're really not talking about this year. We're really talking about a resumption of business from 2022 onwards. And what we need now is investment so that we can reap rewards in the future. You know, we do have, you know, very good business on the books for 2022, 2023 and onwards, and over $1 billion in the pipeline until 2033. But our challenges at the moment is keeping our doors open, maintaining the experience and expertise we have within our industry. And that is why we are calling for government to extend these supports for us so that we can really hit the ground running and take every opportunity in the future that we can, because, you know, we believe Ireland has a very bright future in this sector.
Businesses and attendees have had more than a year now of virtual conferences. Is there a concern among your members that conferences, as we know them, just aren't going to come back? They're gone for good.
Oh no, absolutely not. I think they're, you know, we're all humans, and what we want to do is to have live face to face meetings. But there is no doubt out that I suppose the model has changed, and what we have done over the last 14 months is we have been very agile. We have had a number of virtual meetings, but for the future we see this being really as a hybrid model going forward, a blended model between having live face-to-face meetings on site in Ireland and equally having a virtual online platform where delegates from all around the world can actually join the meeting. And we do see that this actually is a business opportunity going forward, because we believe that we will actually increase delegate numbers attending these international meetings, but based and hosted in Ireland.
Okay. Marina Finn, co-chair of the Association of Irish Professional Conference Organisers, thank you very much for that.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Almost 25 to 8 now, and Des Cahill has the sports news.
Yeah, and we're starting with last night's big football action. It means this year's Champions League final will be an all-English affair after Chelsea beat Real Madrid to reach the decider in Istanbul. Chelsea dominated the second leg at Stamford Bridge. Goals in either half from Timo Werner and Mason Mount secured a 2-0 win on the night, 3-1 on aggregate. So Chelsea will now contest their third final when they play Manchester City, who haven't contested the European final since winning the old Cup Winners' Cup back in 1970. Here's one of Chelsea's stars of the night, Mason Mount.
Great performance on tonight. It was a tough game. You know what they're like. They're going to come and they're going to give it everything. Foley is brilliant. We worked hard. We should have probably had about five. I should have had one 20 minutes before I scored. But look, the most important thing is we won tonight. We want to go into every game winning it, but it's not over. There's one more game left.
Sense of relief when your goal went in, that second one. You could feel it wash across the stadium.
Yeah, definitely. It was 1-0, but it didn't really matter, because if they score, they're back in the game, and they're going extra time. So to get that one late on, you can see by the celebrations, very massive goal for us, and it gives some breathing space for us in the last 5 minutes.
And what about the prospect of an all Premiership Champions League final? You've got a dress rehearsal this weekend as well coming up.
Yeah, we've got them Saturday. So we've played them three times already this season. So it's going to be a stunning game.
It is. I'm looking forward to it. Tonight we'll find out if the Europa League final will also be an all-English affair. Manchester United probably have one foot in the final already. They take a 6-2 lead into the second leg away to Roma. But Arsenal have a bit more work to do. They're 2-1 down to Spanish side Villarreal going into the second leg at the Emirates Stadium. Now, the Premier League game between Manchester United and Liverpool that was postponed on Sunday after the fans' protest at Old Trafford will now be played next Thursday, but it means United will play 3 league games in 5 days. At home, Waterford FC have confirmed the departure of manager Kevin Sheedy and his assistant Mike Newell from the club. Waterford are currently bottom of the Premier Division, having taken just 6 points from their opening 9 games. The head of the club's academy, Mike Gagan, will take charge of the team for Saturday's game with Drogheda United. Now, Rory McIlroy has labelled plans for a proposed breakaway golf Super League as a money grab, saying that the PGA Tour are right to threaten bans to players who play in it. 11 leading players are reported to have been offered contracts worth up to $50 million to play in the Saudi-backed initiative. The PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan warned players who sign up they would face immediate suspensions and potential lifetime bans, and they may be deemed ineligible for this year's Ryder Cup. The British and Irish Lions rugby team to tour South Africa in the summer will be named at lunchtime today. Warren Gatland will name a group of 36, 20 forwards and 16 backs. There's a concern the number of Irish players chosen will be affected by the fact there's no Irish representative on the coaching staff. The one Irish player, though, who's universally expected to be one of the first names on the list is Wexford prop forward Tadhg Furlong. The former England international Ben Kay explained why Furlong would be the first man on his team.
Well, we saw what happened to England in the final of the Rugby World Cup. I think to beat South Africa, you're going to have a pretty decent set piece, and they're going to attack at the scrum. So I'm going to go with my tight head prop first. I know it's not the most exciting, but this guy, the way he plays, is very exciting. A lot of defenders beaten, and I am going to go for Tadhg Furlong. It's a key position. He adds a lot around the field, but that scrum's going to be all important.
In cycling, Sam Bennett won the opening stage of the four-day Tour of the Algarve. He led home a sprint finish, narrowly beating Danny Van Poppel to the line. And finally for now, racing this evening is at Tipperary and the first race is at 4:20.
The possibility that investment funds may be blocked from buying up entire housing estates and how much a can of beer is likely to cost under the minimum pricing scheme are two of the stories carried on your front pages this morning. The Irish Times and Irish Examiner both lead with the government's response to the practice of investment funds buying up entire developments of family homes. After they came under fire yesterday, both Taoiseach Micheál Martin and Tánaiste D'Oíche Varadkar expressed their unhappiness with the practice. The Times reports, however, that there is a belief in government that investment funds still have an important role to play in providing funding for certain types of developments, such as large-scale apartment schemes in urban areas. According to the Examiner, the option of banning foreign investors from purchasing all properties apart from high-density city centre developments is under consideration, as is the possibility of ring-fencing 30% of all developments for first-time buyers. For its lead story, the Irish Daily Mail takes the line that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael both moved to blame each other for the housing crisis during parliamentary party meetings last night. The Irish Independent leads today with the plan to introduce minimum pricing on alcohol. Senan Maloney reports that a 500 millilitre can of 4% proof beer is likely to cost at least 1.50 under the new rules, while stronger beers may cost closer to €2 a can. An interview with the father of a 17-year-old girl who was knocked onto the train track at Howth Junction in Dublin while she was waiting for a Dart on the 1st of April is carried on the front of today's Irish Sun. The girl, who was helped back onto the platform afterwards, luckily only suffered minor injuries. Gardaí are investigating the incident, which was captured on CCTV, which shows a youth on a bicycle at the scene where the girl fell. The Irish Daily Star leads with an interview with former boxer Joe Egan, who talks about his friendship with Jerry Hutch, who is wanted on a European arrest warrant in connection with the attack at the Regency Hotel in which David Byrne was killed. For its lead story, the Irish News reports that patients suffering from rheumatoid arthritis and other debilitating diseases are facing 334-week delays to see a consultant in Northern Ireland. And the Belfast Telegraph leads today with the story about allegations against a locum doctor who worked at a number of hospitals in the UK and Northern Ireland, which are being examined by a panel of medical practitioners. Back in the front of the Times, it's reported that spectators might be allowed to return to sporting events on a trial basis in July. The Examiner has a story on its front page about how a Cork-based research company, Atlantia Food Clinical Trials, is offering €700 to people to drink what's described as a super broccoli soup once a week for 6 months as part of a study to see if the vegetable can reduce the risk of diabetes. There's a story in today's Mail about a family farm in Dromisk, County Louth, which has set up a vending machine which dispenses bottles of milk and milkshakes made from their herd of Frisian and Jersey cows. Tomás Smith tells Helen Bruce that the milk shack works on a contactless system and that the machine they use refills their glass bottles and steam cleans itself automatically after every bottle is filled. Tomás had been thinking about selling directly to the public for 10 years, but once COVID came along, he decided to go for it. And so far, he says he's been delighted with the response. And finally, also in the Mail, Rebecca Dore reports on a range of line of duty T-shirts and hoodies, which have just been launched by Donegal-based company Paper Press Ireland. Husband and wife, Mark and Jerry Hall, have used some of the more memorable lines uttered by Adrian Dunbar during the popular BBC series, including Holy Mother of God and Jesus, Mary and Joseph and the Wee Donkey.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And here's Des back with your sports news.
Yeah, hi, Anya. A really impressive performance from Chelsea last night means we'll have an all-English final of the Champions League in Istanbul. Chelsea beat Real Madrid at Stamford Bridge last night 2-0 to win 3-1 on aggregate. The goals coming one in either half from Timo Werner and Mason Mount. So Chelsea will be in their third Champions League final. They'll be seeking a second title when they play Manchester City, who haven't contested a European final since they won the old Cup Winners' Cup way back in 1970. As you'll hear, Chelsea's manager Thomas Tuchel made history last night, but first he summed up the game.
First half was difficult because they had a lot of ball possession, made us suffer. But every ball win from us was dangerous. We were dangerous with counter-attacks. We never lost the hunger, we never lost the desire to defend in first half. Second half was even better structure to defend. It was a fantastic performance in second half, and we could have scored so much earlier, so much more to be safe. But no time for criticism now. It's a fantastic achievement and a big congratulations to the team.
You're the first manager to do back-to-back Champions League finals with different clubs. Hmm. So you must be doing something right. It's a nice little piece of history.
Yeah, or not, because it's not the same club. It depends who you ask. No, I'm happy. I'm very, very happy that we achieved this. To like you say, I'm in general very grateful to have the opportunity to live my life in football and to this passion as a profession. This is more than grateful, and to do it on this level and to coach a team like this and to arrive now a second time in a final, I'm very thankful for that, very grateful.
Now, tonight we'll find out if the Europa League final will also be an all-English affair. Manchester United surely have one foot in the final. They take a 6-2 lead into the second leg away to Roma. But Arsenal have a lot more work to do. They're 2-1 down to Spanish side Villarreal going into the second leg at the Emirates Stadium. The English Premier League game between Manchester United and Liverpool, postponed last Sunday after the fans' protest at Old Trafford, will now be played next Thursday. But that means United will play 3 league games in 5 days. At home, Waterford FC have confirmed the departure of manager Kevin Sheedy and his assistant Mike Newell from the club. Waterford are currently bottom of the Premier Division with just 6 points from their opening 9 games. The head of the club's academy, Mike Gagan, will take charge of the team for Saturday's game with Drogheda United. Now, Rory McIlroy has labelled plans for a proposed breakaway golf super league as a money grab, saying the PGA Tour are right to threaten bans to players who play in it. 11 leading players are reported to have been offered contracts worth up to $50 million to play in the Saudi-backed initiative. The PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan warned players who sign up they would face immediate suspensions and potential lifetime bans, and they may be deemed ineligible for this year's Ryder Cup. Here's what McIlroy had to say.
They first contacted me back in 2014, so this is 7 years down the line, and you know nothing has really changed. Maybe the source of the money's changed, or the people that are in charge have changed, but nothing has happened. No sponsorship deals, no media deals, no players have signed up, no manufacturers have signed up. It's been through so many iterations at this point, and I think people, you know, you go back to what happened last week in Europe with the European Super League in football. You know, people can see it for what it is, which is a money grab, which is fine if that's what you're playing golf for, is to make as much money as possible. Totally fine. Then, you know, go and do that if that's what makes you happy. But I think the top players in the game, you know, I'm just speaking on, you know, my own personal beliefs. Like, I'm playing this game to try to cement my place in history and my legacy and to win major championships and to win the biggest tournaments in the world. I mean, that's why I'm playing this game.
Now, the British and Irish Lions rugby team to tour South Africa in the summer will be named at lunchtime today. Warren Gotland will name a squad of 36, 20 forwards and 16 backs. There's concern the number of Irish players chosen will be affected by the fact there was no Irish representative on the coaching staff at their selection meeting yesterday. Gatland explained the selection process from a long list of 57 names.
It's a challenge, but it's a good problem to have, and kind of make one of people to be aware that, you know, we've got 50 odd names between 5 or 6 coaches, and I understand that there is always a difference of opinion. Member selection is only a matter of opinion, that we're going to find it tough, and other people are going to, there's going to be differences of opinion everywhere, but that's part of sport, and want people to realize it's just not my selection. You know, the way that I like to work is that, you know, all the coaches will get a big say in terms of who they feel should be a part of the squad.
In cycling, Sam Bennett won the opening stage of the Tour of the Algarve, narrowly beating Danny Van Poppel to the line. And finally, racing this evening is at Tipperary, where the first race is off at 4:20.
Cynical and untrustworthy, the words SDLP leader Colm Eastwood used to describe the British government earlier in the programme. His anger prompted by a unilateral decision in London to bring a statute of limitations on most troubles crimes. And that's a breach of the Stormont House Agreement. And it came as a surprise to Dublin when it was briefed to the London Times and Telegraph last night, and that has just been confirmed by Minister Coveney's spokesperson. John Finucane, the Sinn Féin MP for North Belfast and son of murdered solicitor Pat Finucane, is on the line now. Good morning to you, John Finucane.
Good morning, Anya.
Your reaction to this, were you surprised, or however unwelcome from your point of view, did you regard this as being probably inevitable after that collapse of the trial of two former paratroopers on Tuesday?
Well, there's a couple of things. First and foremost, I think that the decision and the announcement, this leaking by the British government, is divisive. It's toxic, and I think it's something that needs to be condemned across the board. I don't feel that it's a reaction to one particular trial in Belfast this week, but what the British government have been doing for quite some time is peddling a narrative that is quite frankly dishonest. They have played to a very particular base within their own English constituency, and they have consistently used rhetoric like vexatious prosecutions and that there is a lack of balance in the way legacy prosecutions are being looked at. That, quite frankly, is untrue, and those statistics have been contradicted by the PPS, the Prosecution Service, and also by the police service here. And I think that this act by the British government, essentially what they are doing is a continuation of a policy, which is that they do not want any accountability at all for their actions in Ireland, where many people were killed over a very long and sustained period of time. And where I think people's focus needs to be today is for those families who have been waiting up to 50 years for any type of information or justice or accountability. And it's not just a breach of Stormont House, but it's also a breach of the commitments that they made in the New Decade, New Approach Agreement, whenever the institutions were back up and running. They committed to legislating and bringing enacting Stormont House within 100 days. I think within 100 days they made it very clear that they weren't going to do that. And it is yet another example of the British government taking unilateral action to breach an international agreement. But to do that in the context of legacy is exceptionally divisive and exceptionally toxic, and I think that this announcement needs to be condemned, and I think the Irish government need to be very strong in their response to it also.
Yes, but the Minister Coveney could not have been clearer, according to his spokesperson, in warning the British government against any unilateral move. It's been briefed to the media in London that this is happening. Do you think the Irish government, the Northern Ireland parties, I mean yourselves and the DUP, both against this for different reasons, have you any power to stop it?
Well, I think that we have the announcement and we have the intention. I think what we need to do is have a clear look at the actual detail of the legislation. As I understand, it will be announced in the Queen's speech next week. But I think that leaving aside the political reaction, which is exceptionally important, I think even from a legal point of view, you know, that the British government in a fairly stark vacuum. We are not in the middle of a legacy process at the minute, but as a fairly stark vacuum, taking unilateral action to make sure that the rule of law does not apply, that there will be no accountability for people involved in crimes up to and including murder. I think that is something that needs to have people step back and understand the starkness of this. And it applies across the board. You know, this is not something that will solely apply to families who lost loved ones as a result of British state actions, whether that's police or the army or the intelligence services. This will apply to families across the board, and the hurt that will be felt by families will be no greater or lesser than other families. And I think that this is something which the British government are deliberately imposing, but frankly I don't think they care very much about the repercussions of their acts.
But do you not think people who were involved in crimes during the Troubles, who haven't spoken up publicly or in many cases even privately about this for fear of prosecution, will they now take part apparently in a truth and reconciliation process that will be part of these UK government proposals? And Brandon Lewis also talking about a truth discovery museum in border areas. Are they not good things?
Well, I think with the greatest of respect, whenever the British government and this particular Secretary of State talks about any type of truth recovery process, I think it's fairly clear to say that their credibility when they talk about anything such as that is destroyed. They don't have any credibility, I think, whenever they approach the legacy process. This is not something which is being constructively proposed in the context of helping families find out information. The the reason why they are doing this is very clear. They do not want any of their actions being held under spotlight. They do not want any scrutiny being placed on their acts. I have watched that in my own family for over 30 years, and other families are now at the receiving end of this. And I don't think the British government have any credibility when they say that they have any commitment to truth recovery or reconciliation. And I think that it is exceptionally damaging the path in which they have quite deliberately chosen to go down.
John Finucane, Sinn Féin MP for North Belfast and son of murdered solicitor Pat Finucane. Thank you for talking to us on Morning Ireland.
And the issue of investment funds buying up entire housing estates has caused considerable political tremors. There's been fierce opposition, criticism and considerable unease among government TDs at Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael meetings last night. Both the Taoiseach and Tánaiste have expressed unhappiness with the practice, and Micheál Martin has told the Dáil it was unacceptable and will be examined. The Green Party leader and Minister for the Environment, Climate and Communications and Transport, Eamon Ryan, is here in studio. Minister, good morning.
Good morning.
What are you and the government going to do to stop this practice that we're seeing now, where first-time buyers are further forced out of the property market by these deep-pocket investors buying up almost whole estates?
We do have to stop it. We can't have people being frozen out of the market. We need a whole variety of different solutions, but we can't have one investor being able to buy up, as I said, particularly on an entire estate. Minister O'Brien indicated, Dara O'Brien, a number of weeks ago, that he was looking to address it. Within, I believe, the best approach is in the planning system, where we can, with regulations, using designating the approach that are taken in different areas, stop the practice, particularly where large estates, as I said, every single house is bought out. It's legally complex and difficult. There are constitutional issues around property, but we will do it. I believe the best approach is through the planning approach, and it'll be Dara O'Brien who set that out. Critically, though, it's part of a wider approach. If we just did that, that wouldn't work. The affordable housing bill and measures introduced yesterday are going to be key. There has to be alternatives too.
We went through the affordable housing bill in some detail over the last 2 days, but staying with stopping these investment funds, are you talking about a ban?
I think in the planning system, there's a whole variety of different powers where you can designate or set regulations within conditions within planning permission and so on, so that you restrict the practice.
Can we explore some of those choices? I mean, could you be talking about restricting in the planning process? Could you do this one house, one individual or one couple?
Well, you could say that houses could be sold individually. As said, I don't have the details. It does have to be worked out by the Department of Housing in terms of how it's done. But the government has committed not to allow our housing market become dominated by large institutional investors who freeze the local families out of the market completely.
Okay.
There is a role for those investors. We do need a mix of different solutions. We do need large apartment developments. We need to particularly implement the National Planning Framework, which promotes compact development, and that will see a whole variety of measures, including and critically the state. The key thing, the reason I mentioned affordable housing in my mind, is that the state also operates, particularly through the use of measures like cost rental housing and apartments, where the state is in the market, where the state helps give people choices and options. The market is not functioning. We cannot rely on it. It is not the key lever to get us out of the housing crisis. It has to be other measures.
Okay. Do you know, or has the Cabinet received figures, how many houses have been bought up in newly developed housing estates in this country? I'm not talking about apartments now, Minister. I'm talking about houses in housing estates.
I think very, very small numbers. You have to remember the number of these investors.
Do you have a number?
No, but I'd say it's in the minimal, no more than 100 or 200 or that sort of small number, hundreds.
But we know now that there's all but 35 of the houses in Maynooth, so that's about 140, 145
It's not widespread, and we have to stop it becoming widespread.
And when will you stop it? How quickly can you move?
Dara O'Brien will move as quickly as he can within the legal constraints. It may require legislation. It does take time, and when you're addressing changes in the planning system, but the government is committed to doing that, and at the same time, rolling out the whole variety of different housing options we need.
Okay, I want to turn to Northern Ireland and two issues. I know you had a meeting yesterday, a resumed meeting of the North-South Ministerial Council with the Infrastructure Minister for Northern Ireland, Nicola Mallon, and this time the DUP leader, Arlene Foster. Did you know when that meeting took place yesterday that the British government was planning moves on this amnesty for army veterans who might be accused of and brought to trial on offences committed in Northern Ireland?
No, I didn't. I think we have to be just slightly careful on this. You have to remember, firstly, the news of that has only been reported in two UK newspapers. It is the morning of an election in the UK. There's also stories running in the UK papers about gunboats heading towards Jersey. And people, you can understand in politics, people sometimes play to their base. So we have to be sensitive, not just respond to newspaper headlines. But I know the Minister of Foreign Affairs did meet Brandon Lewis, the Secretary of State, yesterday. He made very clear at that meeting that we don't, we oppose unilateral moves with regard to the Stormont House agreement, that this is a highly sensitive issue, that we are thinking first, our thoughts first and foremost are with the victims and people who are seeking justice in this whole process. And we will strongly protect that Stormont agreement. It's agreement between two governments, every party in the North, except for, I think, for it was the UUP back in 2014 agreeing it. You don't abandon those agreements lightly, and we will seek to protect the
provisions. Okay, just clarify for me, did Simon Coveney know or was he briefed by Brandon Lewis at their meeting yesterday that this was on the cards?
I don't believe that it was discussed yesterday. The Stormont House agreement provisions were discussed. Simon Coveney, I think, made it clear that we didn't.
But this move would be a breach of the Stormont House agreement if the British government were to move on it. So I'm wondering if in that context then it was revealed to Simon Coveney by Brandon Lewis, or he had a heads up that
I don't believe it was, because as I said, had it been, it would have been a clearly very serious issue in that meeting. It would have immediately raised real concerns, which would have been addressed straight away.
Now, you had your own meeting, as I say, of the North-South Ministerial Council yesterday, and Arlene Foster took part in that meeting. Have you any assurances that with the change of leadership in the DUP, whether that's to be Geoffrey Donaldson or Edwin Poots, who's already refused to attend one such meeting, that these Ministerial Council meetings are in any way back on track?
I think they have to be, because they're part of the whole agreement. I'm very glad that we also have a British-Irish Council meeting now coming up next month. I also had a meeting with Minister Poots on the environment side, and actually there was a high level of agreement on the benefits we can get on both sides of the on all sides of the island in maintaining high environmental standards. So that was I saw that as a really practical example.
But did you say to Arlene Foster yesterday, or when you met Edwin Poots, can we take it now? We're back on track here, lads. That these meetings are going to go on.
I'll be honest. You get into the business of the meeting. You kind of
this
you
is
get
important
down to the
stuff.
It is surely, but the
in
the, way
in the context of what's happening in Northern Ireland.
It is surely,
Ireland
but
at the
I've worked for in several occasions now, formerly back in 2007, 2011, with Arlene Foster, and again in this administration. The way you work with people is get down to the work, get on with the measures that actually improve the lives of your people, the practical measures that actually bring benefits to your people. And it's by doing that, it's in the actual doing, you make the case, you show that this is needed, this has real benefit. And that's my, I think, was the approach yesterday at our meeting, which is a very, very positive one. It's actually getting on with the work, which is, I think, what the people on both sides of the border want us to do.
Okay, can we move on to the vaccine rollout, which is continuing? We're told up to 240,000 vaccinations this week. We've had Leo Varadkar talking about potentially returning to a relatively normal life by August of this year. We've had the Taoiseach talking about potentially trialling outdoor sports events by July. How do you, Minister, see the next 2-3 months panning out? And with a particular emphasis, you know, in your own area of travel.
I would agree with what both Taoiseach and Tánaiste just said. Can I just say, I think we need to look at it in a 2-3 year time frame. There was another development this year that's very significant, this week, where government agreed in principle with our European colleagues for a very large purchase into the next 2 years of Pfizer vaccines, mRNA vaccines, which would continue to adapt on the basis of variants of concern that may arise. And that's really important. So COVID is not going to go away. It'll probably convert from being a pandemic to an endemic. In other words, and it's a real issue about the divide between the richer north part of the world and the southern. That's
indeed,
a separate
but
issue
members of the public and businesses want to know the immediate minister.
Yeah, okay, but I think they also need to know that it's not stop start, and the prospect that that purchases for the next 2 years of new versions of the vaccine, which allow us to protect against variants, in my mind is key. What that will allow us to do this summer is to start the opening up process. We'll have to be careful, particularly in the next few weeks, but we're very close now to being in a much safer place. And yes, I expect further measures of relaxation in June, and then again in July and August, including the opening up of international travel, the return to college, critically, the return to work, the workplace for those who aren't already in the workplace. Most of us still are in truth, but there will be a return to much more normal life. But the critical thing is then that we go into the autumn and we have the further backup that ongoing vaccination, which covers any potential variants. That's the way we'll manage this over the next 2 to 3 years.
On into the future. Your chief science advisor, Professor Ferguson, and it's an Irish Examiner story this morning, talking about the widespread use now of home testing, fast testing kits. Do you support that?
Yes. These are very different. If anyone's got a test so far for either PCR or an antigen test, it can be uncomfortable as it's taken, and it has to be taken by someone else. These new tests are much easier to do. You can apply it yourself, much easier to do. Not as accurate, but it does have a very high accuracy if you are actually transmissible at that particular time. By taking them twice a week, it allows us to have a screening process that will actually be able to identify clusters early, particularly for the likes of return to college or return to the offices, where people can do that on a routine mass screening basis. I think it is going to play a significant part.
All right. I want to ask you very quickly about driving tests. People are waiting. Sean Sherlock raised this from the Labour Party in the Dáil yesterday. People waiting 6 months for driving tests, and they're not able to access driving lessons. You promised, he said, to deliver 20 pop-up driving test centres. Will you deliver?
Yes. And on top of that, an additional 40 inspectors who will be able to carry out tests. And on top of that, because this is a critical issue, particularly for a lot of younger people, we need to provide, or we're going to start now within this month doing online theory tests. So there's a backlog on those and in the driving test. And we will provide additional staff both for the theory tests and for the driving tests, so that we do clear the backlog quickly. And that's
how quickly?
Well, the theory test typically it's about in ordinary times we do about 15,000 a month. I want to double that. Okay. And similarly, when it comes to driving tests, those extra 20 centres, those extra 40 in inspectors, and if that's not quick enough, we will add a further 40 again. Is what we've agreed. But it does take time. In ordinary time, it takes several months to get a test done. But we will clear the backlog within a matter of months.
In one sentence, answer Hazel Chu or Claire Byrne, who are you backing for the Green Party for the Dublin Bay South by-election?
Either would make a very good TD, and we're looking forward to internally selecting our candidate and then running a really good campaign.
Minister Eamon Ryan, thank you very much for joining us.
Pave Point says the best way to overcome vaccine hesitancy in the traveller community is the testimony of other travellers who've had their jab. And Pave Point has recorded videos of travellers giving their own positive experiences of getting the vaccine. Among them, Nelly Collins from Coolock in Dublin.
When I walked in to get it, they were very pleasant people. And she came over and told me where to sit and she gave me the injection. In fact, it didn't hurt at all. It's just like getting a flu needle for the flu. Yeah, a bit sore there, but you expect that after an injection. But I'm lying to nothing else. I'm fine. And some of the worry took away from there. But I did hear a lot about it before I got it, that it can do this or do that and you'll get the not as bad for you. But I didn't believe when I heard the Pope getting it, I got. Because they're not going to kill the Pope, are they?
So if it's good enough for the Pope, it's good enough for Nelly. Ronnie Fay, the co-director of Pave Point, is on the line. And obviously Nelly Collins' experience, a very positive one. But given the HICWA recommendations that the travelling community should be prioritised in the vaccine rollout, how is the vaccine rollout going amongst travellers?
Good morning, Anya. Well, it's only at the planning stage in terms of the rollout amongst the general traveller community. So older travellers like Nelly have, like the older people in the general society, have had access to the vaccine. So what we're looking now, because as you know, HICWA and the National Immunisation Advisory Committee have recommended that all travellers be prioritised for vaccine. So we're suggesting, you know, that we need to look at a very pragmatic approach to how that gets delivered and implemented. So some travellers will be able to access it through their GPs, others through the mainstream mass vaccination clinics, but we're also suggesting that in some areas they may look at doing outreach pop-up clinics on traveller sites where there's large populations. So hopefully the HSE, they've been very collaborative in their work throughout COVID, mm-hmm. will work with us on seeing what's the most effective way to get the vaccines rolled out and the uptake amongst travellers.
And you must be concerned, you know, the level of outbreaks, 16 outbreaks and 65 new cases in the traveller community in the last week. That's double the week before.
That's right. And, you know, the numbers are high and have been throughout COVID. You know, travellers have experienced COVID, which is why they've been recommended for vaccine. But I think people need to recognise, you know, that there was large health inequalities prior to COVID. You know, that we know the mortality rates are nearly four times the national average. You know, that there's low life expectancy, high rates of chronic disease. Also the fact, and we've all learned this through COVID, you know, your living environment affects your opportunity to protect mm-hmm. yourself from COVID and to adhere to public health messaging. So if you live in larger family groups in very overcrowded and in very poor living conditions, it's very hard to stay safe. So the health inequalities, the poor living conditions and the, you know, the bigger families and living mm-hmm. in very overcrowded conditions makes it very hard to protect yourself.
Indeed, and the Health Protection Surveillance Centre has said the traveller community is the vulnerable population most affected by COVID-19. Can I ask you, Ronnie, do you think there's been a higher level of non-compliance with the restrictions amongst some in the traveller community, or is there more attention when, you know, people in the traveller community break restrictions?
Exactly what you say. You know, it's a minority of travellers who have who haven't adhered to public health guidance. The majority of travellers have been exemplary and have really done the best to protect themselves and their families. But unfortunately, you know, the spotlight gets focused on, you know, whether it's a large attendance at funerals or a wedding, like you reported earlier in Longford. You know, that unfortunately the whole community gets stigmatised by that. You know, we don't condone that behaviour. We've said it's unacceptable for anybody, including travellers, you know, to have large gatherings during a pandemic. But unfortunately, as you kind of adhere to, the whole traveller community gets stigmatised and vilified when some travellers don't adhere to the public health guidelines. And it is only a minority. Like, we have examples in our own organisation, you know, where people haven't attended their own children's weddings, where grandparents haven't seen grandchildren. You know, people have been really, you know, doing their very best under really, really difficult circumstances to try and protect themselves and their families and their whole community throughout COVID. And one of the things that's been really important has been the whole of government approach to working with travellers and travel organisations throughout COVID. And what it shows is, you know, that when that effort is put in and when we have joined up thinking and joined up resources, what's possible. And there's been some very positive positive developments through COVID in terms of provision of services to travellers, and what we have to see is post-COVID, you know, hopefully that day will come sooner rather than later, you know, that we continue to have that joined up approach, and public health in particular to be involved, because through their engagement, you know, we've had water and toilets and sanitation, electricity, fast tracked onto traveller halting sites, and we urgently need the publication and the implementation and the resourcing of the National Traveller Health Action Plan. Hopefully that will happen and be a legacy of COVID.
Thank you for your time this morning. Ronnie Fay, the co-director of Pave Point there.
We're going to talk finally now to our London correspondent, Sean Whelan. Today is dubbed Super Thursday in the UK, with voters going to the polls for a set of elections, Sean, that could shake up British politics. Will you set the scene for us in England, Scotland and Wales?
Certainly will. Well, I'm talking to you from Edinburgh, where the most important election is going on in Scotland. Polls have been open for almost 2 hours now. The Scottish Parliament, 129 seats in play here. As we know, Scottish National Party pitching for this majority, 65 seats, the important number there, to give them what they regard as the moral right to hold another referendum on independence. We've also got the Welsh Senate in place, 60 seats there. The Labour Party, just shy of a majority last time, one seat short, minority government there. They will probably hang on and continue as the party of government there, possibly in an alliance of some sort with Plaid Cymru against the Conservative Party. Then you've got a bunch of local elections going on in England. A lot of them were held over from last year because of the COVID pandemic. They've all been lumped in together in this year, and that's why they're calling it Super Tuesday, because you've got something like 46 or 48 million people who are eligible to vote in elections somewhere in England, Scotland and Wales. Northern Ireland, no elections until next year. And also the COVID pandemic is going to have an effect on the timing of the results, because you can't cram as many counters into the counting centres. So it's going to drag out the results process. But certainly the COVID pandemic and Brexit are the key background factors against which this election is taking place. And it'll be a judgment, the first judgment on the politicians of the country.
And briefly, if you can, Sean, looking south from where you are in Edinburgh, HMS Severn is on the front of the London Times, one of two armed patrol vessels heading for the Channel Islands. What's going on?
Well, the cynics would say, isn't it great to stoke up a bit of Brexit patriotism? You send out the gunboats. There is an issue there to do with fishing licenses around Jersey on the Channel Islands to the French. There has been a dispute concerning something like 17 vessels. The French have reacted very strongly to these vessels being blockaded, as they would see it, from Jersey waters as a result of the Brexit fisheries agreement, the post-Brexit fisheries agreement. The French fishermen have mounted a protest. About 80 vessels have sailed into Saint-Hélier Harbour and then withdrawn from it this morning. But the British government had sent two gunboats along to keep an eye on proceedings, because one of the French ministers, the Minister for the Sea, had threatened to cut off electricity if this isn't sorted out. So they both governments are trying to talk it all down. And so far, it seems to be a peaceful process.
All right.
But it is an indication of how tense things are.
Sean Whelan in Edinburgh today. Thank you very much. The Children's Ombudsman has said that more effort needs to be made to ensure Ireland's education system reflects wider society. Niall Muldoon has expressed a particular need for diversity in the teaching profession. In her final report looking at racism in Ireland, our social affairs correspondent Alva Keneally looks at how one Cork school has achieved integration among students and teachers.
When you say proud of himself, what do you mean by that? Why would he feel proud of himself, do you think?
Religious studies at Bishopstown Community School. Here, when students look around the class, they see different colours and cultures in their peers. It's evident, too, at the top of the classroom.
We're going to leave question three for a moment and we're going to go straight on to question four.
Conor McNamara is Roma by birth. He and his twin brother were adopted by their parents in Tipperary town at 10 months old.
I suppose we were kind of very much integrated into Irish culture. So that was a big part for us, the fact that we went to a Gaelic school, the fact that we played Irish games, we played GA, and, you know, Sean O'Gahalpin, when I was younger, was a massive inspiration to me. One, because he was a Gaelic goer, and two, he was the only person that looked like him, his brothers, that looked like my brother and I. So I mean, following him as a young kid, he really inspired me. It made me think that, you know, I could be a GAA star, I could be successful, I could do anything I want to do. And still, even though I look different, I could still be as Irish as anyone else.
Both brothers became teachers, and today the classroom is different to the one they experienced growing up.
We were in the minority in terms of physical appearance. Now, not how we felt in our souls, in our hearts, we felt Irish, you know. But definitely we knew we were different, we knew we looked different. So I think nowadays kids, they can look around the classroom and say, well, that person, well, you know, there's three or four people they have a point of reference to. It'll take a bit more time for those generations to come through. But there, you know, there definitely is a discrepancy in terms of what's in front of the teacher and what's in front of the student.
And what's in front of the students is important, particularly if they're from minority backgrounds. Mariam Malotiku and Jakob Paco are fifth-year students. Mariam is also chair of the student council.
Even seeing Mr. McNamara as like the physical embodiment of working hard, beating whatever stigmas that one may face, being different, I think it's very important seeing someone like that in a position that he is. Just, I guess, it gives you a lot of inspiration for opportunity in your own life.
As much as the school is small, it contains a lot of spirit, you know, like essence to cling on to. It's like a family almost. And that's what I think people from different backgrounds and cultures can bring. Another layer to build on with a student, like a teacher-student relationship. That's why I would want to become a teacher.
And future teachers like Jakob are encouraged through the school's career guidance. There's recognition of the value they could bring to classrooms in the future, like what Mr. McNamara is bringing to their classroom today. Here's the principal of the school, Edwina Gottstein.
Providing those role models to students adds to the rich experience for their post-primary education. So I suppose it's a conversation that has started in the school. And Mariam, as chairperson of the student council, would constantly converse with me about that idea of representation and representation of people of colour in media and in teaching and in SNA and all the different roles in a school. So I suppose more needs to happen in that area for students to be able to identify with those particular role models.
And by seeing role models in the education system from all backgrounds, the Children's Ombudsman believes this will lead to a more equal society. Niall Muldoon has had to highlight that children from direct provision have experienced racism in school from both pupils and teachers.
Listening to the children, we deliberately wanted to ask them what was the community of Ireland like for them, how welcoming had it been. And they were very clear that they'd suffered racism. Every group of children we spoke to had suffered racism in different ways. So those sorts of things just need to be raised in our consciousness. You know, and I think across the education system we need to start looking at trying to get diversity into the teaching profession. We need to look and work very hard at being proactively anti-racist and progressively integrative and looking for diversity in everything we do. We need to keep working harder at that, and I think that has to happen across the whole community and across the education system, particularly at the moment.
But is it the job of schools to resolve inequalities? Professor of Migration and Social Policy in UCD, Brian Fanning.
I think it's a wider job for government. I think it's a wider job for local leadership. I think it's a wider job for you know, localities. I think we're in a very good starting place in the sense that, you know, there's an awful lot of positives in Irish society. At the same time, we're very good at brushing problems under the carpet at times. And I would hate to think that this generation will be castigated as the generation that pushed the problem of racism under the carpet.
And that's Professor Brian Fanning ending that report from Alva Keneally. And you can hear all of Alva's reports from the series on the RTÉ News website.